Hey everyone, welcome to Manufacturing Hub. It is Wednesday. We are continuing our Industry 4.0 discussion. Super excited to have Adam back on. We'll go ahead and introduce Adam in a second. If you guys are new here, welcome. If you guys are here for the first time, welcome back. We do our very best to have four conversations every month. This month we're talking about what is Industry 4.0 and have four very different viewpoints or opinions. And this is certainly a different viewpoint and opinion. And I will just go ahead and prepare everyone for that a little bit. If you guys are here for the first time or you guys haven't been on our LinkedIn chat, that is where we've got the most conversations that we have. So please feel free to go ahead, head over there. Assuming we don't have technical issues on the LinkedIn side, we'll do our very best to go ahead and pull in some of those chats and questions and comments during this. If we do, we'll still do our very best to do it. And especially with Adam here as our guest, I am sure we will have a bunch of super technical questions that we just cannot, given time constraints, answer here live on air. And we will do our very best to go ahead and get back to them. Without further ado, I'd like to welcome everyone to Manufacturing Hub episode 151. Adam Gluck is back. He is our guest. As I was telling Adam, I went to look because he had been on before. Adam was our guest all the way back at episode 28. And I like to joke, we told Adam he couldn't come back on until he grew his beard. And so if you guys are watching live, here is Adam with his beard. So Adam, thank you for coming back. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm super excited to be back. Yeah, let's not let it go another 100 episodes before we hang out again. But I'm excited to be back. I always love these conversations. And yeah, you were mentioning when we were chatting before this that we all caught up at the trade show. I think it was autumn in the spring, and that was a very fun conversation. So once we get going, it's hard to stop. So I get why you want to limit exposure.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us again, Adam. I know that we've introduced you last time, as Dave mentioned, that was quite a few episodes ago. Could you give us a bit more, again, about your background? I want to learn about your DevOps background at Uber, and ultimately, how did you found Copia and where you guys are at today?
Yeah, as you said, CEO, founder at Copia. I've been doing this now we've been funded for 3.5 years. The company's been going on for 4 years, and I was working on the idea for a year. So it's almost been 5 years now. I've been working on Copia related stuff. So it's getting to finishing the early career of a typical arc for people who are working in industrial roles. I actually said this to someone at a trade show the other day. I was like, I've been doing Copia for 5 years. He's like, great. I've been in my role for 25 years. It feels like a long time, but in the scale of the industrial world, it's not that long. But over the last couple of years, I think when we talked last time, our product was really focused on source control. I think one of the big things that's happened since then is we launched a product called Device Link, which is backup. A lot of how we think about the company has changed as well. So one thing that we tend to look at is through a visibility and control angle, like how do you control the set of changes that are happening in an industrial environment? And really it's this kind of, in a lot of organizations, black box of changes that are happening in industrial environments, people making changes to code, et cetera. How do you build a process? How do you move from a reactive disaster recovery type process to a proactive industrial DevOps? So that's in the Copia evolution in terms of how we think about the problem a little bit and some of the features we've launched. And then in terms of my background and how I ended up in this space, you know, as you mentioned, I was at Uber. When I started off on Uber's driver team, one of the things that was compelling me was the bits and atoms at Uber in 2014 for pure software solution, moving things in the physical world. There weren't that many companies, fast growing companies at the time that I could have joined. Uber was one of those. I was working with the app that drivers used. I did that for 3.5 years, 2 rewrites of the driver app. We started up with 100,000 monthly active drivers. By the time I left, we had 4 million monthly active drivers, 200, 300 engineers at Uber. We had 3,000, 4,000 engineers by the time I left. All this DevOps practices that we're talking about, we put in practice in various parts of our stack in order to maintain a highly available system. Obviously, one of the questions we ask a lot of companies is how much money do you lose per hour if your stack goes down? And during my time at Uber, it was something like $10 million for half an hour of Uber being down. So you're really talking about quite a lot of cost on revenue. I'm sure it's actually much higher than that now. It's really like a huge number of trips. And then on top of that, individuals are relying on it. So that's my bits and atoms world. And then I was always looking at what are the fundamental kind of structures that exist, fundamental tool chains, fundamental workflows. And automation has always been interesting to me. So I've been digging in, and people often be like, how do you come up with a startup idea? And I'm like, I spent, you know, 3 years, 4 years looking into a market and trying to understand it really well, understand the problems. I stumbled across PLCs, robotics code, all this stuff. I was like, seems like there's a missing workflow here. And then I started talking to industrial engineers. And I was like, hey, like, why does this exist? I'm sure there's a bunch of workflows. I'm sure I'm just like some idiot from the software world who like doesn't really know what's going on. Tell me if I'm being stupid here. And everyone's, no, we don't know why this doesn't exist. And like, we think it should. And so that is the three or four of the first five people I asked said that. And then some of them, I was like, well, if I built this, would you try? And they're like, yeah, for sure. We'd love this. We really want a solution like this. So that initial early traction carried me through. And that's been the story since then. Every time I describe the problem that we have, people get it. This does feel like a missing solution. I think it's a missing fundamental component of a tech stack that's increasingly software driven or has more code involved in it. And so that's how I moved into this. But it's really the bits and atoms, fundamental problems in the economy, fundamentally the systems that really drive us and deliver value in people's lives. And I view automation as the core of how all of this hangs together, which is like modernity and humanity at this stage. I think we're the people building out those sorts of solutions. So long answer, but hopefully I hit both things you were wondering about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that definitely makes sense. But maybe, Adam, to take a step back, because I know that many, I want to say, engineers in the automation space or someone in manufacturing may not necessarily be familiar with what DevOps is. Could you give us maybe, I want to say, a layman's explanation or like a simple version of what DevOps is, but also to maybe contrast of what you could expect to see in a very mature software practice versus, let's call it, the middle range manufacturing plant of the industrial space?
Yeah, for me, and it took me a very long time to get to this description, the way that I like to describe it is this. There is production, there's system running. People make changes to that system. And then as a result of those changes, from time to time, they break things. In the industrial space, the total lost output due to downtime is something like 10 or 11%. So if you look at a scaled enterprise, you're looking at some outage at some number of sites every month. It's systemic. Most of those are a function of changes. Going to environments, obviously, you can have components break and that sort of thing. Industrial DevOps, or DevOps in general, is a set of interventions to prevent things from breaking. So it's a set of processes you can put in place to make it so that you're less likely to break something when you make a change in an environment. If you look at software DevOps, like the standard DevOps of the form of which we're imitating right now, those look like some standard set practice. The baseline is just source control. So that's instead of copy, paste, rename, which is every time we do a webinar or anything like that, we ask people what percentage of people are doing copy, paste, rename to keep track of their industrial files. It's always 80%. And we talk to hundreds, thousands of customers or opportunities or potential companies every year. And that's the most common answer. Copy, paste, rename with a new date at the end. That's the change. That's the standard practice. That's best in class. Not best in class, but it's a standard practice right now in the industrial world. So managing source control with code review, good processes to make sure that you're ensuring you don't break things. Then you have to look at, can you actually validate that those changes are having visibility into what's happening? So that's where our Device Link product has come in. We have a backup solution there, but part of the big benefit we're realizing is dashboards with visibility on, like, are people making frequent changes? When are those changes happening? What are they? You know, automate testing. Let's have robots check your code before people do, before you deploy it. And what I mean by that is not robots of the type that we're used to in this environment, but robots of the like automated test runner or a sim running or that sort of thing. Have it run a check on all your code before you deploy it into a physical environment or into production. Then a deployment system, gating deployment to make sure you have the right code actually on your machines. The code that you said yes is approved. Make sure that code that you approved is actually the code that's running on the machine. And then you have observability. There's a ton of observability solutions in this space right now with like SCADA and all of that. And that's been around for a long time. The one final kind of layer on this that I'll add is really what I look at when I look at DevOps as opposed to some of the existing solutions. As I said, there is SIMs right now, and there is monitoring and all this stuff. The entire mode of development is reactive in the industrial world right now. And I heard this great phrase from John Pillar, actually, when we were starting, I know you all know well, when we were starting the company, which I think he said that there are cowboys and firefighters in the industrial space. And so, and maybe one of you all said that to me as well, but basically there's cowboys and firefighters in the industrial space, and you have people making changes and people trying to put out the fire. And our whole goal as a business is to move from the cowboy firefighter mentality, from a reactive responding to outages, to a proactive set of processes that enable us to make changes without breaking things, and thus unlocking the productive capacity of industrials and controls engineers to build more stuff and optimize and do all that great kind of productive net value add work, as opposed to being a cost center, just keeping a system alive. So it's almost like a fundamental shift in what it means to even be an engineer once you have these processes in place. Sorry, that's a long answer, but...
I really like that, especially the analogy of cowboys and firefighters. I guess John probably did say it. I've not heard it, or maybe I just forgot it, but it is an interesting, and I guess I see it immediately as you described it. But let me throw one last question at you before I pass the mic to Dave, Adam. And that is, ultimately, we know that these practices exist in the world of software. What are the challenges to just to someone, again, coming from the IT side that might not understand everything that's happening on OT, to just take them and reapply them? Is it, as you said, maybe the lack of certain tools? Is it the lack of, or maybe a different architecture? Is it a maybe just a knowledge gap? Is it all of the above? Could you elaborate maybe why, let's say, the industrial space doesn't just take whatever the software space has already solved and reapply it on the OT side?
Yeah, and there's been a little bit of this like why now question. Our solution is based off Git. And so when you look at Git, you look at like just a source control, standard source control system. If you try and apply that to industrial space, it just doesn't work super well. Part of it's industrial file types. So basically every different vendor has their own file types, their own kind of mode of even expressing something as simple as ladder logic. Everyone has slightly different ladder logic rendering, all this stuff. So you have a fractured vendor environment. Basically every scaled enterprise is multi-vendor now. If you go to a site, even if you just look at, we like Rock tends to play with Vanek a lot. You can see some of even across different types of devices, you're seeing a multi-vendor environment, all these places, but everyone has their own tool chains. And so if you use Git, they don't work with those tool chains super well. It's a fractured multi-vendor environment. And then you're also dealing with a physical environment. So when we talk about device link and backup in these environments, we're actually connecting physical devices in the plant level and integrating that into a, you know, basically a cloud-based process of review and then validation to make sure people aren't making unauthorized changes in the environment. So if you look at that, you could have a Git solution right now off the shelf, but people didn't adopt it because it just didn't work super well fundamentally in a physical environment that you need to deal with the reality of these things are running on devices, and then also a multi-vendor. And then the other thing I'll say just as a last point on this is, when you think of industrial DevOps, these systems are fundamentally cyber physical, right? And so I think a lot of people think of it as almost like a naive software analogy. And I think that's where we came in. But one of the things that we try to do are like, number one cultural value is like low ego. And was like, okay, how are we being stupid right now? And one of the things I said immediately is probably stupid is to assume that it's a one-to-one analogy between software and these physical worlds. So one of the things, for example, is it's obvious if an outage in the software world happens due to a code change. In an industrial cyber physical system, you might have a motor that keeps blowing out every 3 months and be like, why is it blowing out? Someone made a code change a year ago to solve something. And then no one actually recorded that. And then you don't know why this outage is happening. So it has a physical manifestation, but it's a result of code change. And so that actual visibility problem of what if these changes are code changes, et cetera, starts to become a harder, more complex problem. So you're dealing with a real cyber physical system. And so deployments, all these things that you can take for granted when you're deploying to a cloud EC2 and a website, rollback, all that stuff is not the same here. And you have to be more thoughtful about how these workflows happen.
Absolutely. I'm going to jump in here because if I don't, I will not get a word in for the entirety of the show. So I do want to say I absolutely remember John Pillar being quoted or given the credit for cowboys versus firemen. And we've got Dan Winchester in the comments saying, here's a cowboy. Maybe Copia in 2024 for Automate, we can convince you guys to get cowboy hats and firefighter hats, and that can be the branded giveaway, but you've got to delineate as to what you are. We've also got Matt and Caleb and Juan in the comments talking a bunch about this. So if you guys are in the comments, please feel free to go ahead and jump into chat. I want to dig into this, but I think the next question is going to lead us into digging into more of these a little bit more. And Adam, so we pitched you the idea of coming on to talk about Industry 4.0, and you had maybe a little bit of a unique take, maybe a little bit of a hot take. Frank Lamb is in the comments saying, me calling Industry 4.0 fatally flawed is a bit harsh. But Adam, I want to give you the center stage to tell us your thoughts on Industry 4.0. And I think it's going to lead us to a bunch of these application solutions we were talking about.
Yeah, I think I used an explicative that started when I was, and then had an S in it when we talked about this originally. And I have a little bit less caffeine in my system now than I did at that time. I'll be slightly chiller about it. But yeah, I think my strong take on Industry 4.0 in terms of how it gets applied is that Industry 4.0 is not actually a description of a concrete set of problems that exist in industrial environments. It was designed as an economic system for Germany by German scientists who said, this is what our program is going to be for our economy. And then it was popularized to the WEF, who basically talked about it as a description of all the exciting things happening in the industrial world. So basically, it started from a set of analysts, theorists on how the economy works, And then you have people trying to make decisions on the plant level or in industrial companies using something that's a theory about the world, the theory being you have an interconnected supply chain, you have all this data and all this stuff, which is true, but they're trying to then work backwards from that huge, very basically bird's eye view system description to concrete problems. And so when I say Industry 4.0 is fatally flawed, what I actually mean is I think we need to reorient our focus to the plant, to the production line. There's a story that I often talk about, comes from Adam Smith. It's from the first industrial revolution, which is that Adam Smith talks about, like, why do we automate any process? And basically what he says is you automate process because you're lazy. You don't want to do something, and then you realize you can optimize a little bit. And the story he gives is someone in production, unfortunately a child working in a factory, but where basically he had pulled two levers and he ties a string between them and realizes he just needs one lever instead of the other if he ties a string. So that's a very naive mechanical form of automation. And so to me, if you look at the history of automation, look at the history of industrials, the 250-year history of industrials, it's been a pragmatic set of solutions. Like, why do we have PLCs? Relay systems are really hard to program because you actually have to plug in different things. So let's put on a computer instead. That's a real problem that you solve. It wasn't like I sat there and was like, hey, cool. Do you know what's cool? AR. I bet we could use this in a factory. No, someone's like, I have to change this line. I need to make changes. So I'm going to go in and I need something that can make the changes more easily. That's smart. That's intelligent. That's solving real problems. And so when I say Industry 4.0 is fatally flawed, I haven't seen an example of a top-down system description functionally actually helping us get to better answers about concrete problems. And so the way that I look at Industry 4.0 is, or 5.0 or whatever the heck we're calling it these days, I'm shocked that in 7 years went from 4.0 to 5, because it really took 70 years for each other industrial revolution category to happen. But when I look at that, I'm like, hey, there is great technology, there's AI, there's all this data gathering, there's cloud, all this stuff. We use a lot of this stuff, but let's go back to what are the concrete problems at the plant level. What are the concrete problems in industrial environments? What are things that we can't automate right now that now we can? What are things that we can automate, but we automate poorly? What are problems as a function of increased automation, which is where I view industrial DevOps? Let's look at those problems, solve those, and then you build up to the strategic and ROI and all this stuff. But I don't think the top-down works. And I think that the people trying to paste a top-down solution to problems don't work internally. I'll give one last thing on this. Sorry, I guess this is almost the theme of it. I keep saying one last thing. One last thing on this. I was at a trade show back in the fall, and I did a rollout session. I started with the question of ROI, which I don't think is the only lens to look at anything through, by the way. I have another thought on that. But I said to a group of people, all who were like data analysts, who had been working on innovation stuff, I said, give me an example of one digital manufacturing initiative. This has been around for 8 years, 10 years, that you've generated ROI on. And no one raised their hand, and actually derailed my entire discussion, because I thought I was gonna get like an example of this and be able to work through, but I was like, why not? We got into a really interesting conversation. The example that what people were always saying is these were failing at the plant level, and that these initiatives, what the things that they were pushing for, didn't make sense to plant folks generally. And so I think that's emblematic of a top-down solution. Now, when I see Industry 4.0 work, people find a concrete problem, it's measurable, and there's a solution to it, and they're building it up brick by brick in the organization. So when I say Industry 4.0 is fatally flawed as a top-down, theoretical, frankly, government-programmed way of looking at the problem, as opposed to a concrete, there's real problems at the business level, at the plant level that we're solving, building up for, I think it's fatally flawed in that way. So maybe I'm harsh, but I think that the perspective's wrong.
And I guess, how can we approach to solve that, right? Because I think from my experience, I've also seen initiatives that come in and push a enterprise level solution to the plant level without fully understanding all the nuances. It usually doesn't end up well. And at best, it stays there for a couple of years until the next one gets proposed and maybe implemented. But how can we, I want to say, enable the people at the plant level to find the actual problems better, right? Because I think they also don't always have the right tools. They don't have maybe necessarily the right channels to funnel those problems into. So it's difficult, right? I don't think that the three of us will revolutionize how it is done, let's say in the next couple of months, but I guess what can we brainstorm as ideas to enable people to find those ideas better?
Yeah, what was I going to say? There's a little bit of, like, left hand not talking to the right in some organizations. So people like literally will come up with something at a trade show that they think is cool, or they'll have a rolling, like they're supposed to analyze AR this quarter, and then they try and like an AR solution or something like that. And they're not going to the plant people to begin with, or actually understand what's happening there. For example, like one thing I asked people about at this trade show about, we were trying to come up with the definition of industrial DevOps, is like, how much time do you spend talking about outages? They're like, we spend a lot of time trying to understand outages when they happen in our environment. So that's where we were starting to get into some of the industrial DevOps like problem. Just talking to people in the environment, I think, as a first order. The other thing is, I think at any top-down initiative, it tends to start really broad and not really hone into concrete problems. I think if you go to any plant, you can see that there is maybe some inefficiency on some line, or you can see some set of problems that people are facing in those environments, or you can find some part of the organization. But I think the real challenge is digging into the organization and figuring, hey, you know, where is there a problem? You know, I've even seen solutions, frankly, that are just like, hey, first, we're just going to measure the performance of this line. When is it down? Oh, it turns out 20% of our downtime is during changeovers. How do we make changeovers more efficient? You can actually just come in and measure. Literally, if I were at an enterprise industrial company right now, and I were to build an industry 4.0 type initiative, I'd start by just find some lines or some production environments and just hyper measure them and start looking at what's happening there, and then find the most solvable thing that I can measure, and then see if there's a technology to solve that, and then build up from there. It would be really ideal. I know that's how some people do it, because people get to success. When I see it fails, it's the top down. People do that, and they actually reach incredible success. So I don't want to say that it doesn't happen, but I think when I see it succeed, it happens in that way. It's that hyper focus on the real business problems, as opposed to waving an AR wand, for example, or anything like that, or waving an AI wand or whatnot.
I see a focus on AR here, so maybe I can ask you what your thoughts are on the Apple play in the AR space. They're releasing like a new headset that I think is going to be, a few steps ahead of what's currently on the market.
Yeah, I'm historically long AR, but as I get older, I like reality more. So I'm like, even if I'm looking at my phone recently and being like, I'm like mentally ill, I'm addicted to this thing. So now I'm like, reality is pretty, it's pretty beautiful, the world around us. I feel good about it. I see a sunrise, that should be enough for you, overstimulated brains. But AR for production, I've seen great demos and all that stuff. And I've seen environments where people like augment reality in different ways. I've seen in production environments, people do that sort of thing. That's exciting. So I don't have any issue with any given technology. I just think it's like, what's the problem? And then find the technology that enables you to solve it. Or is there a problem you couldn't solve that now there's technical unlock? For example, I think I see lots of great demos with like directions for operators. You know what I mean? And that sort of thing. That's exciting.
Every time I've tried to use AR on the floor, it's really great in theory, but then we have to have people whose average age is 40 to 50 go use potentially this new piece of technology. And I've tried a couple of the single eye ones. And man, if me sitting in front of the computer trying to get it to do the thing I want it to do, and I'm struggling to see this tiny little screen, I'm like, there is almost no chance of success for people who are not technology forward to go do that. I love the first HoloLens that I got to play around with from Microsoft. I think that was super cool. I think it was way too expensive to go put out on the factory floor, which is most of the feedback that I heard from people. I love the concept of, I think it's Vision Pro is what Apple is calling their new headset. I love the concept of it, but if a HoloLens is too expensive, a $3,000 or $4,000 Vision Pro is too expensive. But if anyone is listening and would like a technologist to go trial to see how they can do it, absolutely give me a call. I would love to get my hands on one, and we can see what we can do for you there.
Yeah, bought a Magic Leap right when it came out, because I was like, okay, so on AR, and it was like very fun for an hour, and then I an amazing party trick. I was like, hey, everyone put on this AR glass, and like, oh, it's so cool. It was nice for a cocktail party or something, but it wasn't like a great tool that I turned into anything useful or used on a regular basis.
Absolutely. So we've got a couple of comments that I want to make sure. We've got a couple of technical feature requests from Matt Paulson, but I will not put you on the spot with those technical feature requests from Matt. You're welcome. And yes, Juan is talking about how standardization is key. Is talking about how there are already IPCs that leverage digital twin standards to represent discrete manufacturing. So absolutely, I think we see lots of standardization. Vlad and I did an entire theme on standardization, and I think there was a very heated debate that was there was no conclusion because I'm a big fan of overbuying and standardizing on one or two of anything. And Vlad is the technologist who wants to go try a whole bunch of other fun, different PLCs. And then for anyone not watching, you can just look at the entire PLC wall behind Vlad. And at some point he will give us a walking tour of the like 400 other PLCs he is currently surrounded by. So we've got that. We've got John in the comments talking about how latency concerns about implementing real-time data analytics and machine learning at the plant level. And then asking, so what is it? Oh, I'm sorry, John, I misread that. So Adam, I will kick it over to you. So John is saying, is latency issues a concern for implementing things? Is that something that you have seen and run across?
Yeah, so this is not my expertise because we don't do machine learning at the plant level. That being said, we have looked a lot into what does real time look like. And actually, there's a really interesting white paper that Rockwell put out a while back with, I'm drawing a blank, Cisco, on the real-timedness of different industrial processes. So basically, it's talking about what can you put on the network and what can't you put on the network. And the actual real-timiness of certain processes are different. So you could say, what does real-time really mean? It's okay, nothing's truly real-time. You know, like there's always some amount of latency in place, right? Yeah. And there's lots of processes that are slower that you can actually use this sort of thing. Discrete manufacturing processes, different stuff as well. So it's you could probably Google it and just be like Rockwell, Cisco networking. And it's a really great, it's like a great primer on just industrial networks in general. One of the things that really stuck out to me was like the graph there. And then at that point, it becomes a pretty straightforward equation, right? You're like, how long does it actually take to respond to this input? And does it fit within the confines of the sort of process that I'm building? And like my general sense is like slower, as I said, I'm not an expert, but slower processes you would typically use, you maybe put in the cloud. Maybe you'd want to do on-prem for reliability reasons as well, that sort of thing. But I think there's some interesting data out there, interesting ways of looking at it. But I think I'd really investigate what we mean by real time in these environments and what the real time requirement is. And if it's like switching a config owned by three tags on a PLC, and it doesn't really matter if that happens in minute one or minute two, like it doesn't matter. So I think it's really dependent on the requirements of the system that you're building.
Yeah, I will say, if I can comment on that side too, and again, I'm not an expert in ML, but I know that latency is always a concern, but I think it really depends on the architecture, right? And as Adam said, it comes down to, do you want to keep that data on site? Do you need to send it on the cloud, which is going to add different layers of the latency and ultimately lead to different decisions. But depending on what you need, you can always throw more money and resources at it to solve that problem. I don't think there's ever an issue with latency that is unsolvable with the right, I want to say, like server infrastructure and database locally if need be, and then solving whatever in the cloud and passing that information back.
Yeah, I will say,
I should say
generally I'm long cloud decentralization and edge. I do think we're going to move a lot of compute to the edge. Ultimately, as like cost of energy goes down, as compute gets cheaper, I just think that like more and more of this stuff will happen on the edge, probably driven by real-time requirements, because you can only improve networking to a data center by so much. And so there will be some set of requirements that drive more and more edge. And then there's a lot of great edge solutions that have come out from every vendor over the last couple of years that I think are really exciting and show a lot of investment there. So I do think I am long edge. I think we'll be doing a lot more on the edge over time. And I think, but I also think the edge from a tooling standpoint will look more like the cloud as it is right now. So like we use Kubernetes. There's a lot of Kubernetes at the edge tool chains that are like starting to be really good that we're starting to look at. So.
Yep. Absolutely. I would definitely agree with you on that. I did want to bring up what Matt has said, and I'll try to paraphrase his question because I think it's an interesting point, right? So he's making the point that a lot of times in your PLC programs, you're going to have certain set points and configuration parameters that are not going to be monitored as part of what is released, right? So you're not going to see those change as the program gets modified on a live system, but it's rather stored as a file and ultimately gets different configurations for different machines. So he's making the comment there might be something similar in the DevOps space. And I guess, again, reading that makes me think of YAML files for, let's say, your Kubernetes clusters or even like Docker containers. So he's asking if there's like a practice to be able to back that up automatically and I guess monitor those changes for the runtimes versus what is currently like on the system. But it's, I made the comment, it's a feature request maybe for you guys or something to look into. I think it's a could be interesting. Yeah,
I think it's interesting. If you take a step back on the initial problem statement that I brought up on like, what is industrial DevOps solving for? It's this idea that people are making changes. People make changes, and often when you make changes, things break. That's like most frequently when things break. Obviously, you can have predictive maintenance, you can have pieces of hardware breaking or whatever, but oftentimes things break because someone did something most of the time, right? And so I view configuration as a component of that. And then obviously the solution to that in the DevOps space has been, for software, has been Terraform. There's a little bit of a joke, and I hope my SREs aren't here, but that like SREs are like YAML engineers. They would joke with me too on it. But it's like you're doing a lot of engineering in configurations that are all text-based, right? And you put those into version control because you want to be able to see those changes. And then you're using the same system of Git as an underlying infrastructure for managing changes, like a very good change management system for also your configurations that are all existing as code. So it's basically like creating a basic unit of code. And so if you're going in and you're having to plug in your IDE to make a change to a config, or even if you're doing it through an HMI or something like that as well, like you're actually missing critical context about what's happening, changes in that environment. And then so how do you recovery or understand if there's an outage or whatever? Really gruesome story is I think people saw the eye stuff that was happening this year, maybe with the eye cleaner or whatever, and people are losing their eyes because some factory in India made some change to their formula.
Oh yeah.
Causing bacteria. And you can go through the kind of audit they did. And one of the things they said is they think they maybe made a change to a config somewhere in the process, which changed the heat or whatever, which caused the bacteria to grow. And so that was one of the things that they're investigating, but there's no record of config changes, right? So these are, that's a gruesome example. These are really important changes ultimately as you're changing formulas and all this stuff. And we need to build a set of practices to do that. I think infrastructure code is a good analogy for that. But I think that it's a really relevant, important question. Oftentimes those are the changes, by the way. Most of the time it is an HMI with some pre-determined configs that an operator is switching is like most of the changes probably happening in these environments, you know?
Interesting. I've not even thought of that causing problems of that nature, but that now that you mentioned, that does make sense.
It was a theory. I think it was one of their hypotheses, one of the things they thought had maybe happened.
Interesting. So we've got another comment, like a follow-up from Matt here, saying how the main issue is the set point data changes per machine and even per changeover. Those values aren't code, at least per TIA portal. They're actually runtime variables, which was his comment. And Adam, I don't know if you want to comment towards that, or we can again say, yeah, no, we will not go drive the next 30 minutes of this conversation directly into that. But thank you so much for all of those comments, Matt. We've got Joshua Workman in here. He's got a Cisco, and I specifically want to bring this up because we'll have Adam take a look to see if that's the correct work paper, and we will go ahead and post it on this show, and we'll have it in the show notes. So if you guys are listening to this on podcast form, you can go ahead and do that. And then we've got a couple of comments in here about securing the cloud from securing the edge. Here we go, from Scott McNeil, and a bunch of other comments about that.
Yeah, we're extremely extreme about security. It's basically, well, there's no trade-off for us in like productivity and it's security. We're like security because it's actually honestly so critical with these systems that are like highly under attack. I know a lot of people, and I have friends who are in cybersecurity at the level of the White House. I know people who are like very, like the shit going on out there is scary. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, yeah. I think you can see the amount of ransomware. We have a security news channel, I think, average cost of ransomware is like $860,000. People are getting hacked constantly. And so I think it's a very valid concern and that everyone should take extremely seriously. And I think it's way under considered. The fact that people take off the shelf 5G devices and just plug them into industrial environments is insane. You see all that happen all the time. And by the way, that's Industry 5.0 or something. It's so great. The bureaucrats invented something else. No, I'm just kidding. That's practical too. That's a little bit like the guy with the toy. So I get it. Anyway, my point being though, that it's very serious and securing the edge is important. That being said, I don't think that we see like, it's almost like schizophrenic in the space between what people consider good security and bad security to be. For example, like we'll talk to people who've been like, it's like almost like they're in a castle. They've been like, I've been air gapping this factory for 20 years. And if you want to deploy anything, you have to use my data center. And their data center is a closet with a rack of, configured. But you get to that level of intensity. And then you have other people who are like, zero trust, put everything in the cloud, all that stuff. And the question is, what are the set of practices? Sometimes you get people who air gap in, then they're plugging a 5G device in, get around the air gap and off the shelf. And what are the security protocols and IoT devices? they're highly poorly defined, it turns out, that the FCC is looking into some of that stuff. Long and short of it is really important. I think we need to get to a more standard, acceptable set of best practices. I will say the current set of best practices that some people think are best practices, like air gapping and putting everything on physical devices, are not secure. And actually, there's a good joke about this in a recent Star Trek series that I was actually shocked that they put in, Star Trek Picard Season 2. They have to go hack a security system at a hotel or something like that. And they I don't know who their consultant is, but they said, the woman who's from the future obviously goes, it's air-gapped, a primitive but effective security system. And so I think that's like a pretty good description of what air-gapping is. We run into customers who are like, we have all our code on a laptop. It's perfectly secure because we just keep the laptop in a factory. And then you're like, okay, they'll come back to us 2 months later. We lost the laptop. Well, we have all their code on a USB stick and it's safe because it's locked in the manager's desk. No, it's not it's not safe. But it's like literally these things get stolen and lost all the time. And there's actually literally people who are like, there's literally like foreign agents who are operating. So it's insane. And to me, my general stance is I think cloud is pretty secure. I think you can build safe protocols around cloud. And I trust AWS to secure their data centers much more than I trust where they have government clients and they have basically every single company in the world using AWS or Azure or GCP. I trust them to secure their data centers more than I trust whatever rent-a-cop you can hire at your site in some area to protect your site from someone coming in and stealing the USB stick that you left on your desk. It's just insane. And then on top of that, air gapping assumes some security and all that. So there's a bunch of reasons why that's just a really bad way of doing things. But I think we need to get to more confidence around securing the edge and cloud security and best practices in these environments. And that's a maturation. But generally speaking, I think that's just baseline a little bit more secure, especially when you look at disaster recovery and all that stuff as well, redundancy in the cloud. I just think it's better. But I understand the concern and I understand like people have best practices that are primitive, but effective ultimately when it comes to air gapping and all of that stuff. And sorry if I offended anyone on the call. I realize this is
I find it surprising that people, again, don't trust the cloud companies or the providers, and then they trust their own, let's say, quote unquote, best practices at the site to not fail. I've seen very interesting approaches, and again, I'm not going to comment on who and what they were, but it's just the world that we live in. And I think as people get more and more educated, they'll hopefully change, but I think it will take time. I guess I'll put it that way.
Yeah. One really funny thing is I get the security angle, but sometimes I hear people say that their own server is more reliable. And I'm like, your server is more reliable than AWS's like highly redundant data center. Like what? So you run into this where you're like, oh, now all the cloud servers are popping up above me that we were talking about earlier. But it's like the failure rate of a hard drive is 2% annually. Your stuff's going to break. It's just going to happen if you're trying to put everything in your local data center or whatnot. So.
To bring us back more into the question of DevOps, Adam, because I think we left a lot of very loose ends on that side, right? And I want to discuss maybe the practical nature, because ultimately I've worked as a control systems engineer and I know what it takes to deploy code, but I also understand now some of the best practices that you've just described from the DevOps side, which are to be able to test the code, to not just blindly push something to the machine, then realize that it failed and have to rework it. So maybe could you paint us a picture of what's possible with some of those best practices for like a tangible for a manufacturer, right? What kind of benefits can they expect as they adopt some of the DevOps best practices?
Yeah. So to me, again, and I just always want to root it, like people make changes and they break things. And everything that I talk about industrial DevOps is the set of interventions between making a change and getting it on a machine to prevent yourself from breaking something. And so I think if you look at that as the overall scope of the problem, you can really start to drill into like specific workflows. Again, source control is a really common one. The reason we like source control is like relatively easy to adopt. And basically what source control means is have a accurate version history of changes, know what's changed, be able to access them easily, which is why I think cloud is a good solution for that. And then have a code review process that everyone follows. Like that's it. And we provide browser-based code review and all that stuff for ladder logic. So it works in these environments. All of that's just like very practical set of problems in these environments that I think that you can start to solve. And I think you can start off with something really easy. And then the whole journey of going from, hey, I copy paste, rename, leaving cowboy and firefighter world to like engineer with the process world can happen in many steps. And I actually think you're not DevOpsed. It's not like, okay, we did 1 year initiative, now we're DevOps. It's actually a set of practices that you invest in over a long period of time. They get more mature over time. And so we think source control is an easy entry point. The thing that I actually often think about is now in the software world, if you're a manager and all your stuff breaks. And I manage managers. So I come in, I'm like, what the hell? Sam's our head of it. Sam, what the hell? What's going on? Get me a postmortem, all this. We do a blameless postmortem practice where we go through and be like, what broke down in our processes that made it so we had an outage? And let's fix that gap in our process. And DevOps becomes the tools that underlie that process to make sure, oh, we don't have good testing. Okay, should we invest in testing? Oh, we don't have good monitoring. We missed this because we didn't have good monitoring in place. Okay, let's invest in that. Those are a set of practices you can invest in over a very long period of time. They get better over time. So your system gets more reliable over time. It's like any engineered system. You improve it continuously. And so in my mind, when I look at these environments, I see firefighter and cowboy, because there's not good process in place. The only actual answer is you have to fire someone if they don't do a good job. That's how these environments are often built. And you get a very stressful workflow. And then the end result that I've been coming back to more recently is engineers are treated as a cost center because they're trying to keep a system alive as opposed to a strategic value add. And then they're compensated like a cost center as well and cut like a cost center as well. And when that happens, and you start to see all this outsourcing and all this stuff. I think if you change the dynamic and you're investing in DevOps practices and suddenly your system's not going down all the time, so you're actually looking at projects to add strategic value to the business, and then you're actually following those steps and investing that, and then suddenly you can get to blameless postmortems. So you're no longer trying to fire someone because they made a change in environment. You want them to change the environment because they're improving things. And then suddenly you have this really nice workflow where suddenly you move from being a cost center to be a strategic value add, and you're compensated like a strategic value add as well. And so to me, I think there's a set of practices that actually also represent a change in what it means to be an engineer in an industrial environment. And I think it all comes together nicely. And so to answer your question, long and short of it is, it starts with something small, like just review the code and have a standard process there, but you can build up to something really big and impactful that actually fundamentally changes, you know, the nature of what it is to be an engineer in a hardcore environment, you know. Now, I'm wrong on this too.
I love that a lot, Adam. So we've got a comment in here from Glenn in the chat, pushing back a little bit on the concept of Industry 4.0 and a bit of what we said. And I'm absolutely going to get to that. But first, I know that you guys have a success case that you can openly share about Amazon. And I want to ask if you can walk us through, because I think that's going to hit one of your initial points, or at least I hope it's going to hit one of your initial points, and then we can have the conversation about Glenn's comment, if you will, Adam.
Yeah, you always learn about your best customers. Always learn from your best customers, and when you work with, they're incredibly talented. The fun thing about this job is I get to meet like incredibly talented controls engineers that add incredible value for their business and building things that are like, to me, that's Industry 4.0. It's like engineers building things that are like you couldn't previously imagine using technology and solving concrete problems. That's incredible to me. So I love working with the team over there. And you learn from your best customers. One of the things that basically we learned from them, and this is in the case study, is essentially they had some visibility, some awareness of changes that were happening in the environment that they're having there. And so this is where we get into the framing of like visibility and control that we like to talk about. One thing we realized is like, people don't even know the frequency of changes in these environments, right? Partly because of that blame culture I just talked about, where people get fired if they change things. I've seen very many funny interactions like this, where someone, I never changed the code. Their manager's like, we made the code change last week via trade show or whatever. It's like literally like that level of real time. The people don't want to seem be accountable for changes. There's kind of this blame game that's going on. Mm-hmm. Okay, they're already past that culturally, but there's a belief in investment and process. And there's this idea that there's some changes going on in these environments. And so first of all, just bring visibility to that. So connecting device link, getting a dashboard, showing frequency of changes. And then once you see frequency of changes, you realize that there's a lot of changes happening in these environments. You start to invest in source control. Source control then becomes the process. Control changes the environment, and you're suddenly breaking that loop from that reactive, hey, there's a disaster recovery mentality. People are changing things. We don't know what's going on. To, hey, we have visibility to changes. We have a process that we're starting to put in place to make sure that there's not insane amounts of unauthorized, unreviewed changes going in these environments. Really, the piece for them, and this gets back to my earlier statement on what makes a good Industry 4.0 project, is understanding a problem, measuring the problem, having a concrete solution to the problem, proving that it's measured and resolved. And you can see that here. Changes are happening. There's a little bit of a lack of visibility into those changes, but we know they're going on. So let's bring visibility, shine a light on it. Let's put device link in, let's get a dashboard, let's see what's happening, and then applying a process to those set of changes. And the other interesting thing is once you start measuring stuff, people also behave differently too. So just by measuring it, you're seeing that unauthorized changes are going down less frequently. And so that was a really good kind of eye opener for us, where it's, oh, this company that operates at the top percentage of effectiveness but this is how they're thinking through and parsing the problem in their own environment. And we learned a lot from that. And that's a lot of, honestly, a lot of my lens too now for some of this stuff. So I don't know if that makes sense, but.
Absolutely. I think that's a good point. I'm going to go pop up the comment from Glenn and I'm going to read it in the entirety for our listeners. And I think it brings a very good counterpoint to the conversation we're having. And so Glenn is saying that we're missing the point of the original initiatives behind Industry 4. True, it was German centric, but the intent was more broadly focused on the integration of systems vertically and horizontally, mentioning IoT and within and between businesses. The original paper holds true today as it did when it was published in 2011. The concepts are starting to mature in Europe now that marketing departments are starting to understand that Industry 4 is not a simple product, but it has a long way to go there before eventually trickles through the rest of the world. It does not help that Industry 4 as a concept is a little bit more abstract than the change from mechanization to electrification. And so one, I think that was a good question. Two, Glenn, thank you for helping me read two of the hardest words of mechanization to electrification that I could possibly need to back to back. And I guess I'm going to give Adam a second and say my piece. Will I give Adam a second to go ahead and regurgitate that comment? I think Glenn's comment is very true. I think it is the difficulty of Industry 4.0 and what it has driven, at least into industry that we're seeing, that has brought up Adam's point of it is easier to focus on individual use cases from the plant floor and find success and go in theory drive up, as opposed to go and have a bunch of executives say, I want Industry 4.0, but not having those specific solutions to go drive it down. Although I have asked Adam the question as to how do we go build some of these great successes on the factory floor and drive them up vertically to the top floor, which is where I have found some of the hardest issues depending upon how an organization is built.
Yeah. So a few things. So very specifically, my point with Industry 4.0 stuff is that it's actually exactly what Dave just says, that it's a top-down description. And I get that it's like a description of how businesses can operate with each other and data and IoT and its infrastructure. And I'm starting to get a little bit of the buzzwords there. But my point was that it's a system level description, right? How businesses operate with each other, how supply chain operates, how plants operate. It's not a like concrete blueprint for solving sets of problems that people are actually facing in their organization. And the translation from that system level description to a like concrete set of like action items in organization is a hard translation. And to me, that is what is quote unquote fatally flawed about it, is that it's actually not that useful as a high level. We already knew all those technologies, because I could list out every technology you talk about Industry 4.0, but it doesn't give you that much of a blueprint of what to do actually at a site level. And I think the practitioners who actually make this stuff useful, A, I think they would have gone there anyway without the Industry 4.0 description, but B, from is that they actually are starting to look into concrete problems, and then it becomes a technology toolkit, and it's a nice description of a toolkit for solving those sets of problems. So for broadly what we call Industry 4.0, those sets of technologies I'm all very excited about. I'm saying Industry 4.0, wow, I don't know why that happened, but hey, Industry 4.0 as it came into the space and in terms of how it's talked about, I think we have to do a lot of work to actually get it to be a set of useful practices that people can adopt in their organization. Now, other point that you brought up, Dave, on top-down buy-in, it's hard. That is a really hard question. And actually, when I start Copia, I had this great description of any product that you're building operates on three levels of value add. One level is feature function. And by the way, as you step up these, you can charge more money. But feature function is, hey, this is a really nice diffing tool. Visually, it looks good. It solves this problem in our workflow. That's super important. Second level is ROI. Hey, I make this line run 10% faster, or I reduce scrap by 15%. And you're like, I'll take 50% of that 15%. Thank you. That's an ROI. A lot of people are obsessed with ROI in the industrial space. And then because that's easy to measure and people are measured on the plant level, all that stuff. Then there's a third level, which is strategic. So, and strategic means you are unlocking a capability for the organization, right? And I think when you see these conversations break down, they're failing to operate on one of those three levels, right? So you either have something that is like feature function. It's really annoying when I check into the office that I have to file this particular paperwork, let's put into a digital monitor. You're not gonna get top-down initiative for that, right? Sorry, that's a dumb example. ROI, it's like sometimes people really fixate on ROI. Often you get things through because business are ROI driven. But I talked to a C-level executive at one point who said, if I saved all the money everyone said that I was going to save, we'd be making three times the amount of, you know, margin that we're. So actually, that ROI description is often a little high. It's kind of flubbed. You can't get that much optimization out at the ROI level, but there should be some ROI there. And then strategic capabilities, that's where you get a top-down initiative, but they don't make sense in the bottom level. There's no ROI, so middle managers aren't excited about it. Or someone at the base of the organization, they're like, this seems like an ROI, but it's a pain in the ass for me to use because you didn't consider that. You created a crazy process for me to get this ROI, right? In order for you to actually get a solution that makes a change. And by the way, I'll bring this back to one other thing. It's a 250-year-old industry. Industrials are very old. So to get some sort of actual meaningful change, it has to operate at all those levels. And then you have to bring in all the stakeholders, all those levels. And we have data on that from our pipeline. If we have deals that have 3+ people and one of them is a manager, those deals do a lot better for us generally, because you can see that buy-in across multiple levels. We have a word, and this is my last thing I'll say on this, on the lack of feature function piece, which is so critical to be user-centric in that way and build something that people actually want. We call it, and someone said this is a really gross description, I never thought of it as gross, organ rejection. Organ rejection is a top-down initiative that individuals just won't do. You just can't get them to do this painful thing you want them to do, right? And then you have the other level of someone that's just solving their pain, but they don't get how that ties to company objectives and they can't get buy-in. And frankly, you just have to do both if you want to have a successful initiative. And I hate to say this, it's just like hard, but you have to understand the levels of value add and who they're adding value to and make sure that whatever you're proposing adds value at every level. And sometimes it's piece by piece. So initially an ROI and then gets to a strategic value. I view us as we have an ROI and disaster recovery. We solve some workflow challenges and we're unlocking strategic value add around that overall kind of workflow piece that I was talking about earlier and enabling engineers to build net new capabilities and collaborate better and all that stuff. But I think we operate on every level there, but you have to figure out how to tell those stories. Sorry, long answer on that one. But.
No, I think that definitely makes sense, Adam. And if I can bring it back to your even earlier example or point, I think what's really important is to find the problems first and then identify how we can solve them and then gather the data, right? I think a lot of times we bring in this enterprise grade solution that can gather all the data, but then it's either overwhelming or just too difficult for the people to fit the problems to the data that they're given. And so a lot of times I think it's the best analogy is a smartwatch that now gives you your heart rate, your steps, your whatever other metrics. But then you actually have to do the work and be able to learn from that data, make changes in order to see those results. And so a lot of times I would see a similar result in facilities where they've brought in the best tools. So the technology is perhaps there, but they don't have the business cases that they're very, focused on and then measure against in order to bring in those results, right? So to that ROI example, we should be at 3x the promised ROI. It's not always on the vendor that the responsibility falls, right? It's not just because you brought in the right tool and it's giving you the data that it's necessarily going to give you those gains immediately. So I think it's also important to recognize that it's a very nuanced and case-by-case application when it comes to Industry 4.0, at least from what I've seen from my experience.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, it has to be like unarguable. I actually heard an interesting thing recently, which I think is another lens of why I think this is also hard in the industrial space right now. Over the last 30 years, people move from having less and less actual controls engineer and industrial engineers on staff. Like we're all pretty aware of that. And that's been a function basically of a bunch of financial engineers. And we have very good financial engineers out there, but that I respect for the job that they do. They're doing their job. But basically what they do is they say, hey, I don't really understand what this guy is doing at this plant, or I don't understand this initiative. Can't we just hire someone hourly to do it? You know what I mean? And so you see this like basically pushing people out of plant environments, and that's the viewing engineering as a cost center as opposed to a strategic value add. Now, basically what's happened is all the companies that didn't do that are now eating the lunch of the companies that did do that. And we're starting to see the shift back to engineering as a strategic value add in our organizations. But I heard this really interesting comment from someone who's been in the space for 20 years, pushing these sorts of initiatives at different companies at a trade show I was at, where he said that it used to be you'd have 10 engineers on staff. You could pick the top 3 or 4 initiatives and you do them. And then you might get into something that has ROI, but not strategic, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But now you have a few core engineers on a company, even pretty scaled companies, and they can pick a couple initiatives to do every year. And so if you do an initiative and actually invest engineering resources on something strategic for an organization, it has to really hit every note, because there's going to be a ruthless prioritization that goes through in terms of resourcing. And it's not that these things aren't important, it's that you have just a small set of people that can actually do that work and make an initiative happen. We often think about that. One of our core company values is get customers to success. Because we think about when we go to a company, do they have the resourcing to do this, or are we going to be supporting them in that? How do we actually get a product? Giving them the product is one thing, but how do you get the company to success as an organization? And that takes a lot of work. So some of this stuff is hard right now, I think specifically because of the way we've structured businesses. But I think the interesting thing that I'm excited about is I think we see this. I see a lot of really top tier companies right now that view controls engineering, that views automation engineering as a core value add, as they've seen how other companies that do that are winning in the different markets. And I'm seeing some really cool, exciting conversations. I think the ambition and vision of a lot of companies right now is amazing. And I think it's really cool. And I think if I am positive on Industry 4.0, it's that it brought that, and a lot of people who are bringing those visions have Industry 4.0 titles. And that's great. Those who are always still great people to talk to in organizations. They're not critical of any of the people involved, just the methodology and the translation.
And if I can follow up on that point, Adam, maybe taking this as a pre-startup to the question that we'll have on the career discussion. If you're, let's put you in the seat of an engineering manager, right? And one of your engineers, senior engineers, listens to this podcast, three awesome bearded guys talk about DevOps and how Industry 4.0 is not all it's made out to be, but he wants to learn more about some of these best practices. He's looking at different training or learning opportunities. He's trying to figure out what DevOps is, maybe what's test-driven development, how they can implement better backups also for their systems. How would you approach maybe training your team of, let's call it 5 to 10 engineers at the plant level in order to prepare them for what's to come, let's say, in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, there's some people who've done this really well. One of them is on the call and was asking me some detailed questions earlier, who are like very good at this organizationally. There's a lot of great books out there. There's tons of different books on DevOps. I just go looking on Amazon and see where the like most reviewed stuff is, because a lot of people have written about Agile, DevOps, all that stuff, these sorts of best practices. Matt could probably ping. He has a book that he really likes here that he could ping in here that's slipping from my mind right now that he recommends. But there's a lot of great textbooks on it, a lot of great literature on DevOps generally. Now, industrial DevOps and getting it to work in the environments that we work in is really nascent. I think we were some of the first people to talk about that. You all can validate this, but we were talking about it 4 or 5 years ago. There's some other people were talking about it at the time, that there's not that many people you all were talking about, not that many people are using the term industrial DevOps. And by the way, the German planning committee that came up with Industry 4.0 didn't talk about industrial DevOps in their list of things. So I don't know if we're technically even in 4.0. But the interesting thing for me is it's a real set of practices that are necessary in the environment, and the conversation is still evolving. So I think the interesting thing is look at our solution and then look at broadly, look at digital twin, look at which is testing in this environment, look at the SCADA solutions that are out there, look at all this stuff and figure out you could build a whole DevOps workflow that looks like a software workflow with the set of vendors that are out there. It'd just be hard. Just go look out there, look at those sets of solutions. And I think it's an ongoing conversation. Part of why I'm here to have a conversation with you all about it is that I think more people should be thinking about things break in industrial environments, how we build a set of processes, how do we reverse the cowboy and firefighter dynamic and start to figure out how we build good process so that we can build the next generation of industrial automation. And so I think there's a starting point in the software world. I think there's work we've put together, other people have put together a little bit out there. I think there's a book called Industrial DevOps that came out that's a little bit broader in scope. And you know, just start thinking about it, get a conversation going at your team, look at that. And then obviously I'd say the easiest way to really just knock it out of the ballpark and do something fast is reach out to us. And we'll meet with someone from our team and we'll get you going with control device link, connect you, get a basic workflow going, train your team and all that. But it's pretty new and I think we're still figuring it out. And I'm bullish on our solutions that we're bringing the space and our vision for some of these solutions, but it's gonna evolve. And I'm excited about, as I said, digital twins and the SCADA stuff coming out. There's a lot of cool stuff coming out right now. And I think it's a really big problem that we're gonna see a lot more people approaching in different ways.
Absolutely. So I think that this, If you'll let me bump in for just a sec, Vlad. So if you guys are looking for more industrial DevOps content, again, listen to our first conversation with Adam all the way back on episode 28. We really dug into what is industrial DevOps. I'm pretty sure I asked him that specific question. We've got Matt Paulison, who Adam was referring to, and Matt has been in the comments. He was episode 112. He had a bunch of book and other recommendations in there. And then also we've got Joseph Waddell, Software Defined Automation. He was on episode 114. So if you guys are looking to listen to our additional hours of what is industrial DevOps and some of those use cases, all of those are really good opportunities. Vlad, I've got a question. I know you've got a question. Who do you want to go first?
I had more of a short comment, so I'll let you go in a second. I guess I was going to say, I don't know if the ISA or the IEC has issued any like standards or comments on DevOps, but I think it would be interesting to see if the industry comes up with something of that nature.
Yeah. Speaking of security, it's interesting if you're SOC 2 type 1 compliant or type 2 compliant and you're a software business, there are a set of expected source control practices that you do, mm-hmm. such as code review that we're talking about and having a record of changes. To be a secure organization, it's very strange to me in general that there's no SOC compliance expectation for industrial companies to have code review for the changes that they make in the industrial environments that they're building for. And I think it's maybe just wasn't a problem 10 years ago because there was less actual hardware running software that people were changing. But now it's actually insane to me that people can operate these environments the way that they do. And then there's just an evolution that needs to happen. I think most people want to see a change, but it's interesting to me that we don't have more actual specification around some of this stuff in these environments, because literally it's not a good way of building a secure business and all that stuff too. And especially talking about the ransomware and all that stuff we were talking about. Sorry.
For what it's worth, Adam, on that side, I can tell you for, I want to say a food and bev company, I'm not going to mention, I had to hand sign code that was printed on paper that would then be filed for audits. So that's how that was handled. And that's 2016.
Yeah, for regulated industries, there's some process. I think it's called validating. There's validation you need to do. So there's a lot of process for change management for vendors that sell into regulated industries. It's like very easy to validate paper. So like paper processes like fault. But that's also, again, another thing that's like bad in our regulatory environment is you can't actually, it's like, it's cheaper and easier to sit with older solutions than to adopt new ones. And so you have, I've heard of organizations that literally won't adopt new practices because they're afraid that their auditor is going to ask them questions about it. And so we get worse tracking and all of this stuff as a function of the fact that we're trying to prevent issues or something somewhere in the chain. Anyway, so, but yeah, paper is weirdly easy to validate is what I've heard. So
I feel like this setup, the question I want to ask, well, and I want to ask it to both of you guys, right? So earlier this week, I was having the conversation of Industry 4.0 and a bunch of other kind of buzzy type words and what is next, right? Like at some point it might be Industry 5.0, it might be Industry 7.0, it might be something else. What is next? The pain point that I have and the person that I was talking with was having is that it's written by people who aren't practitioners. And Adam, I feel like you set that up really well and you said something to that point. And Vlad, I feel like you pulled out some IEC and some ISA and some other items that could in theory be this technical organization that writes it. So I guess my question to both of you is, who do you think is going to write whatever is next for industry? And will we have more description and more of a step-by-step or roadmap as to how to help organizations succeed?
Yeah. Vlad, you want to go first or should I? Okay.
It's an easy question to close up the main questions tonight, guys.
So I'll just go. There was no Industry 3.0 committee that figured out Industry 3.0 and then told the automotive companies to build to get PLCs from the vendors that built those PLCs. They figured out a problem as an organization, and then they figured out a solution. They found vendors to build those solutions for them. I don't think we know what generation or what this is going to look like. I think Industry 4.0 is a hypothesis about what the world looks like. I actually would argue even that we might still be in Industry 3.0. We have a lot of mechanical processes still in industrial environments. We haven't fully digitized yet. I think like we're seeing a massive proliferation of code and software in industrial environments. And when I look at the next generation of industrial automation, I'm seeing one that is entirely basically code-driven, fully digitized, and then us dealing with the challenges of a very code-heavy environment. And I think Industry 4.0 might end up being part of that in terms of the data you can pull out of the environment of all that. But I think the big challenge that we're going to run into is actually a lot more automation, a lot more digital automation, which is really the after effects of what we would call historically Industry 3.0. I think we're actually really in the early stages of that. And the other piece I'll talk about with that is that we have a million job openings in manufacturing right now, so you can't hire operators. And whereas in the last decade, you would basically come up with a depreciation model and you'd say, hey, okay, I got to pay these people hourly, or I could do the straight line depreciation. And if you had a CFO that wanted to make the investment up front, they'd do it. And if they didn't, they wouldn't. That was the automation story. Now it's automate or die. The capital efficiency of our business is measured on our ability to automate. So speaking of top-down buy-in, there's massive top-down pressure to invest in automation for organizations. And then we have forecasted 3 million job openings. So any reasonable industrial company is going to say, hey, we actually really need to automate everything that we haven't automated thus far and make massive investments there. And that's what we're seeing as a secular trend. And so if I can bet on anything, it's going to be a lot more more automation in the next decade, which means a lot more code in industrial environments and a lot more having to understand, deal with the code in these environments and how to program these processes, which I think obviously industrial DevOps is aligned with, but I think that's the future. Then AR and data and all of that comes out of these highly digitized environments for sure. And I think that gives us more intelligence and the ability to run these from the cloud with AI and some aspect of machine learning at the edge. All of that stuff comes into play as a result of a fundamental platform shift that is driven by secular trends. And that might be Industry 4.0. I think the person who's going to write the story on what Industry 4.0 is going to be a historian 20, 30 years from now who notices that we had to fully automate our industrial economy and that had a bunch of effects ultimately. And you're obviously also seeing full humanoid robots and all that shit as well. I think it's like we're in an extremely exciting time. I think that description is driven by the fact we have a fundamental need to automate in our economy. I think that means everyone who's listening on this call right now is extremely relevant to the future of our economy, future of the American economy, future of the global economy. And so I'm energized, as you can tell. And I think that transformation is going to, I don't know what it's going to lead to. That's what's exciting to me.
I like that. I'll try and piggyback off that comment and maybe answer Dave's question is, I think anyone can write the standard, right? It doesn't have to be a current organization. It can be an OEM. It could be a practitioner. I think what's important is a couple of questions, right? Number one is, as you said, Dave, it has to be someone from the industry. It cannot just be, I think I want to say third party knowledge is very difficult to convey a lot of these fairly complex engineering challenges, number one. Number two is how do you form a committee that's interested in this fairly long term, right? Because I don't think this is going to be a problem that will be solved by releasing a white paper in a couple of months. And this is how we do, let's call it DevOps or Industry 4.0 or all of the above, because even in the software space, that has changed tremendously over the last decade. And Adam, you can probably correct me if I'm wrong, but there's constant development. So you need to be extremely organized, I think, in keeping up to date what that standard looks like. And I think historically in manufacturing, we have not done a very good job at that. And some organizations, again, that we've already mentioned, have committees and have fairly technical people there. But again, how do you ensure that the governance is representative of the entire space, that you have the right people in those seats, and that they are, I want to say, incentivized enough to maintain this almost, I want to say, open source standard, right? There has to be a way for them to spend that time and be compensated for it, for better or for worse, for it to be of high quality for everyone. So I don't have a specific answer. I think it can be started by anyone, but I think it requires very diverse people on that board to be accurate.
Absolutely. So I think both of those are good points. And honestly, Vlad, if I were you, I'd be kicking myself for not going in front of Adam, because Adam just gave an amazing comment right there. Having said that, I think I agree with both of you. I don't know what the next revolution or evolution will look like. But almost as a counterpoint, I think the Germans that sat down 12 years ago or 13 years ago to write this did us a tremendous favor, right? I agree with Adam. I think most of us are very much within Industry 3.0. Like, how much time do we spend trying to figure out what the right sensors are? It almost doesn't matter how we connect it, but like, we have sensors and basic automation issues that most groups have to solve as they go towards these Industry 4.0 initiatives. So I think they did us a tremendous service as they went and said, this is what the future is going to be. And honestly, if 50 or 80% of manufacturers get there and it takes another 10 or 12 years, it will still be a tremendous leap forward from what we were in the 2000s and the 90s and the 70s when the original PLCs came out.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I said, I think everyone who's involved with this, it's all very good. You know what I mean? Like, ultimately envisioning new futures, new technology, all of that stuff is really good. My biggest point is just about that translation from that big Industry 4.0 vision to how do you get something that actually operators can deploy and do. And I think that's where the fatal flaw is, so to speak. But maybe it's not a fatal flaw, maybe it's just a flaw. So.
Absolutely. So this has been amazing. Adam, thank you so much. As all of our longtime listeners know, I ask all of our guests the same four questions at the end. And I will shout out John Piller, who's saying that he's got on or got to listen to some of it, and we'll go back and re-listen to it, and it'll just be the dulcet tones of all of us in his ears for at least another hour and a half. You're welcome, John. Having said that, Adam, we want to ask you what the future is going to look like, and we've talked about so many different topics, and so I want to open it up as to get one of your predictions as to what the future of automation, of manufacturing, of DevOps, of any of these things is going to look like, please.
Yeah. And I think I'll go back to my last statement. It's a lot more automation, a lot more processes being automated, automation being more and more fundamental. I think the other trends I look at is like abundant, cheap energy. There's a loan to a Michigan, so it's exciting, nuclear plant to get going again that just came out, $1.5 billion loan to kick off nuclear power there. But more interestingly to me, outside of nuclear, which has its own risks, obviously, is solar, right? Solar is like getting very cheap. The end result of that is compute is very cheap. And so the end result, and then obviously the cost of actually automation hardware is getting really cheap as well, like robotic arms, all of that stuff. So the end result of that is I think we're going to see massive increase in automation in the core of the industrial economy. Again, as I said earlier, I think everyone who's on this call, hopefully people are still on this call, after listening to me ramble for this long, are going to be absolutely critical to building the next generation of the industrial economy. I think even more critical than the past. I think we're going to see in our lifetimes near full automation of most kind of critical industrial processes. And I think that's going to be a stepwise change for how everyone here does their jobs and thinks about what they do. And I think it's going to be a stepwise change for how we live our lives, cost of goods, for, you know, what it is to be a human being. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Absolutely. No. Thank you. Thank you for that, Adam. We want to ask for a book recommendation. I know that you're a book reader. I think you read a bunch of sci-fi. You've already given us a Star Trek episode to go watch. So what sort of other books do you have for us?
Okay, I'll do two books, and they're slightly at odds with each other. One is The Culture Series by Ian Banks, which is another good sci-fi description of the future. It's very hedonistic. It's very like anarchist, like, except I'm not an anarchist, to be clear. But basically, it's a cool description. Just the massive amount of production in the society he describes, they can build ring worlds out of everywhere. My other one that's slightly more on the traditional side is I'm reading a English translation of the Hebrew Bible that came out 5 years ago by Robert. Okay. That's the Old Testament. It's the only person who's been a single individual to translate the entire Hebrew Bible. And he has a whole issue with the way we've translated English for the last 350 years that was not literal enough. And so it's a very literal translation of the Hebrew Bible. And it's really beautiful, honestly. It's just, it's like you get a lot out of reading it, just the way the text comes together and all that stuff. It's a lot better than some of the stuff here. Versions of the Bible that maybe you can read in different places. And not to be overly opinionated about those sorts of translations.
Who's it by?
It's by Robert Alter. Yeah, he basically, his argument is like a very literal translation, which he says the King James Version is the only other version to get close to of the Bible is a better translation. And he takes these different segments and you can really get into it. Like you have certain clauses that like basically people try and turn the Bible into like proper English and it actually has a different kind of tonality and energy. You almost like chant this version of the Bible. So it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. So actually a lot of people I know are reading it right now. But yeah, Robert Alter's, and it's really long. So maybe just read Genesis or Exodus. Get the good books.
4 hours. I found
it. Book. That's the classic good book, though. So I feel safe in recommending that one. So those two are pretty good.
That is a pretty safe recommendation. Yeah. So at least one of them is a safe recommendation. The other one, you have to preface it by saying, I am not an anarchist, which.
Yeah,
thank you for that, Adam.
We want to ask you for one in those two directions.
We want to ask you for some career advice. If someone is coming into industry, or if someone is saying, "Man, all of these things Adam talks about really make sense. I want to make sure that I can continue to work in this industry for the next 20 or 30 years." What is the best advice that you have for them?
So my first advice is always just enjoy what you do every day when you wake up. When I started Copia, I had someone said, she was an art teacher of mine. I did an adult art class. Anyway, but she said, basically, she was like, look, every day I wake up and I make art and I like love my life. You can't buy that with money. So first piece of advice, do you like what you're doing first order every single day when you wake up is get you out of bed? And then two, if the thing that gets you out of bed is solving really hard technical problems, that's amazing. Put yourself near the hardest, most interesting technical problem that you can find that's adding the most value and just keep driving towards that. I think in every technical space right now, there's insanely exciting things happening. And I think that you can just keep putting yourself near the companies, near the problems that you care about and are excited to solve and have a real impact. Just do that. And if you have the ability to do math, and engineer and build things, which not everyone does. And if you have a capacity to do that and you're attracted to it, you have an amazing ability to create, use it and solve hard problems that impact people and feel good about it every day and go to bed and sleep, read your Robert Alter. No, just kidding. Just enjoy yourself. That's my advice, is just like, do what you like, but make sure it's impactful and work hard. So.
Sorry. No, I think that is better than any technical advice anyone could possibly give. So thank you for that, Adam. And then the last question is, who should reach out? Who are you? Who do you want to talk to? Is Copia hiring? Are you guys looking for new customers? How can our listeners help you?
Yeah. So generally, customers always, like, we're looking for great people to work with, organizations that are forward thinking, that are excited about solving problems, excited about the next generation of industrial automation. I feel like very blessed in general with the set of customers that we get to work with and the sorts of problems they work on. If you have a plant that's awesome and I get to walk the floor, great, like, let's do that. That's exciting. Generally speaking, leaders in organizations, technical leaders, people who are just interested in general, just reach out, request a demo, talk to our team. And if you're driving an initiative right now to solve these sets of problems, please talk to us. If you're already like thinking about doing something in the next year and it's on your roadmap, reach out, let us know. Let's chat about this stuff and dig into it. And we'll work together on hopefully delivering value to the organization and hopefully making everyone's lives a little bit better.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Adam, for joining us. This has been an awesome conversation, as are literally every other conversation we have with you. I'm glad we got this one on record officially on Manufacturing Hub, which is, I think, quite literally my comment about 90 minutes into the time we saw Adam at Automate is, man, we should have just had the video cameras rolling because this would have been perfect. But Adam, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, thank you for chatting and hanging out. We've got some questions we have not gotten to in the comments. We will do our very best to go back and get into those, to go answer the questions and tag Adam in all of the places. If you guys are listening in podcast form or in the rewatch, thank you guys so much. You should have links and show notes and all of those things at some point. If we are missing one of the great things that we talked about, please feel free to go ahead and message us. And if you guys are listening in podcast form or on YouTube or anywhere else, please feel free to like and rate us 5 stars and subscribe and share and all of those awesome things. When we remember to ask those questions and also go post these episodes on podcast form, you guys find them and listen to them, which is absolutely awesome. Until next time, we'll see everyone soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Adam.